Hi there, my name's Oisin Lunny and welcome to Audio Talks, presented to you by Harman. And in this episode, we immerse ourselves in the art of noise, which is, of course, a great concept, a superb band name, and more recently, a multi-sensory exploration of how design has changed the way we've experienced music over the past 100 years, hosted by the good people at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. And today, my dear friends, I am thrilled to be chatting with the SF MoMA Associate Curator of Architecture and Design, Joseph Becker. Welcome to the podcast, Joseph.
Thank you, Oisin. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you here, Joseph. And bonus points for that wonderful pronunciation of my awkward Irish name. You have some good skills there. Okay, we're going to dive straight in and start with a very big question indeed. What role has design played in shaping how we experience music over the decades?
That's a great and far-reaching question. Good one to start with. It can't be understated. And I think that the exhibition Art of Noise, the attempt here is to really tap into that relationship and to bring forward how connected our sonic experiences are to our visual experiences. So the exhibition covers over 100 years of these objects and artifacts that tap into that shared relationship between what we experience sonically and what we see visually.
Outstanding. And for listeners who haven't seen the exhibition yet, could you perhaps give us a bit of a virtual audio tour? So, you know, walk us through some of the different gallery spaces and talk to us a bit about what stands out as you move around.
Yeah, absolutely. So Art of Noise is also one of the largest exhibitions that the museum's put on, certainly the largest design exhibition that we've organized in our nearly 90-year history. It takes over the entire seventh floor of SF MoMA and encompasses over 14,000 square feet. So the 800 plus objects really take over a big portion of the museum. And I think showing that dedication to the impact that these artifacts have had on our collective histories is really important. You step into the space starting with a survey of graphic design that really spans from mid-century forward with heavy emphasis on certain moments in time. The San Francisco psychedelic rock moment, for example, is presented in a really robust way. So you're confronted as you enter into the exhibition with a floor-to-ceiling presentation of nearly 500 of these concert posters that span from 1966 to 1971 and take us through a typographic exploration, color and composition exploration, and really saturate us with these attitudes and expressions that tie together the sounds that were coming out of San Francisco at the time and this kind of iconographic graphic design treatment that accompanied it.
Nice. I love it. And folks, if you are going to the exhibition yourselves, you will, of course, notice the wonderfully typographic posters that are kind of resonant of that amazingly creative era in American music and counterculture. So do look out for those. Joseph, how did the concept for this exhibition on music and design first take shape? I mean, what was it like selecting all of these amazing objects?
Again, the show really just skims the surface, of course, on our cultural output related to music, the visual output related to our musical output. And so the task and the joy of bringing together these objects was to try to tell as broad of a story as possible, to capture the nuances between different musical genres, between different moments in time, different media that we've used to listen to music. So the range from radio to cassette to, you know, through 8-track and 45 and the 12-inch and into our digital and streaming access points to music. So trying to encompass this broad range of objects that have been utilized for playback and have become part of our shared experience of listening to music. And on the graphic side, thinking about the relationships between different subcultures and their graphic approaches. So if I were to say to you, punk flyer, you might immediately conjure an idea of a collaged and photocopied flyer. And so teasing out these relationships of different moments in time and different approaches that remind us of how important the visual aspect of our listening experience is, the relationship that we might form between the music in an album tends to be paired with what that album cover art was. And it is both a kind of an agent for our memory, but also there is an emotional content there too, and a relationship that's formed perhaps to a specific aesthetic, say the designs of graphic designer Reed Miles, who did the majority of Blue Note Records covers. And I think for that example, when you see a Reed Miles cover, you might imagine the sounds of Blue Note Records coming out, kind of specific moment in jazz history.
100%. And in fact, when you mentioned those Blue Note covers, I instantly thought of, you know, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, etc., all those beautiful recordings. And when you mentioned the words punk and flyer, immediately thought of Jamie Reed's iconic designs. So yeah, that kind of interplay, that connection between the visual design of these recordings and your response, your emotional response and connection is really, really profound. But this, like you say, is a massive show. You are exploring 100 years of design, which is not a small amount of time. And you're talking about design and how it impacts our musical experiences. So I'm really curious to know, were there any like really massive game-changing innovations or milestones that you uncovered in terms of curating this show?
Oh, so many. I mean, we've highlighted many of these moments in time that have changed the game in a way and how we listen to music. And the way that the objects themselves are presented in the exhibition is grouped by certain themes. For example, one of the pedestals contains objects that take us through a story of portability. And of course, as we walk around today, we carry our smartphones in our pockets and access streaming music, and a near infinite amount of music is at our fingertips. But that, of course, was not always the case. And so to tell a story of relatively recent history and that transformation is really interesting. On this table, we have, starting in 1957 with the Regency TR-1 transistor radio, which was the first commercially available transistor radio. It wasn't the first transistor radio, but the first one to really have market presence and to be a mass consumer object. And that object ushers in the information age, because not only does it provide access to music, and you can consider that as a turning point in the dawn of rock and roll for sure, but it also provides access to the information around the world, the news. And as a third and very important point, it increases the engineering potential of the transistor itself, because this is an object that is now mass produced, and then the idea of technology becoming smaller and smaller becomes possible with this ramping up of production. So that is a really important object, I think, that transforms everything that comes after, including those smartphones that are in our pockets.
Well said. Very, very good choice. And speaking of which, we're now going to move on to a very selective question. You're going to break some hearts no matter what the answer is. But I'm really curious to know, do you have a personal favorite object or design in the whole entire exhibition?
It is really a challenging question. I mean, these are objects that I have studied and formed relationships with over 5 years. I've been working on this exhibition from the earliest kernel of an idea for 7 years and really in earnest for the past 2 or 3 years. But there are objects that tell very different stories. I mean, one that's very close to my heart is the Ron Arad designed concrete stereo from 1983, which he made 10 of. And that was a very subversive object, something that was rallying against our consumer culture and very in line with a kind of punk aesthetic and rejection of the status quo, and taking his audio equipment and kind of breaking it apart and embedding it in this deconstructed concrete, showing signs of decay and really creating a kind of counter attitude to the sleek electronics of the early 1980s. So I love that object. And with a handful of the works on view in the show, we've brought them to life. You can see them turned on and playing music through them. So the Concrete Stereo is one of those, playing Blue Monday by New Order, a song that came out in 1983, I believe. So that's one of the objects that I'm particularly fond of. But on the other end of the spectrum, something that was very mass produced, something that is also very illustrative of a kind of type of emotional response, thinking about our human experience and the way that we utilize music in our lives, is an object designed by Naoto Fukasawa that was produced by Muji, which is a CD player meant to be mounted in your entryway, showing one CD vertically mounted, exposed, with a pull cord like a light switch. So as you enter into your home, you hang up your coat, you pull the cord on your CD player, and it starts spinning the soundtrack for as you walk into your house and go into your next phase of the day, which I really love.
Oh, that's gorgeous. What a wonderful idea. And bonus points for the Concrete Stereo there. You've just reminded me, I'm not sure why, but of the Durruti Column album, where they actually made the 12-inch vinyl cover with sandpaper. And so the idea is you'd stick it on your shelf and it would be kind of surreptitiously eating away at the cover of your other albums. So there can only be one winner. So yeah, the sandpaper sleeve is a good one to play in the Concrete Stereo, perhaps. So this all seems like exactly the kind of ambitious, multimedia, immersive exhibition that would get a curator like yourself very, very excited. Can you talk to us a bit about how you got to where you are? What is the background that brought you to curate this show? And you know, what makes a show like this interesting for you as a curator?
Well, one of the main amazing parts about developing this exhibition was that I reached out to Teenage Engineering, which is a design studio and manufacturer of audio equipment based in Stockholm. I've been a big fan of theirs ever since I curated an exhibition on Dieter Rams and included a small section within that exhibition about designers who had been inspired by Rams's principles of good design over 10 years ago. And so I reached out to Teenage Engineering and asked if they would be our design collaborators on the exhibition design, thinking through what our visitor experience would be if they're coming into a space to see these objects and artifacts, which in a museum you can't touch and you can't turn on. How do we create activation and immersion in something that is very in line with the ethos of all of these objects? And they were incredibly game partners and developed an amazing seating system for our visitors to come in and let go of their day and lounge into a space where they can put headphones on and interact with devices that Teenage Engineering developed specifically for the show. And so those are listening devices and also viewing devices. There's a small TV and a small playback device. So working with them to develop the furniture and also what these devices were was a real treat.
Outstanding. I mean, kind of wind the clock a little bit back before this process of this exhibition kind of started. You say it's been in the works for 7 years, but you know, what kind of led you to be in a position of curator? You know, what were some of your own kind of personal paths or milestones that kind of contributed to you arriving to where you are today?
So I've been a curator at SFMOMA for 17 years now. It's been a long journey with many incredible opportunities to share design and art and architecture with our audience and beyond. And my background is that I studied architecture with the intention to not necessarily practice architecture, but to have a very broad perspective over design, encompassing furniture and product and graphic, but also a real interest in the kind of spatial theories embedded in architecture education. And coming out of the more academic side, I was really tuned in to an idea of being able to share and facilitate more inspirational opportunities by bringing forward the works of artists, designers, and architects that were game-changing. And that very likely stems from an opportunity that I had as a teenager to see an exhibition at the Design Museum in London on the work of the designer Werner Panton, whose work really spanned all of these different design disciplines, lighting and textile and furniture and highly saturated colors, and really this kind of immersive, thought-provoking designer. You know, seeing that show, I think, led me towards design, thinking more about design practice. But in retrospect, the experience of seeing the work of that designer in the context of a museum led me to understand that the role of the curator was what I was honing in on, that somebody had put in a tremendous amount of effort to bring this story together and to share it. So that is the path that I've so far taken.
Fantastic. Fascinating path there. And I wonder how many teenage minds are you lighting a fire in and aspiring to go on and choose a career in art and design and curation in this overlap between art and music and all of the good stuff in life, I would say.
If I can do that at all, that is my number one goal.
I'm absolutely sure you've done this many times over. And talk to us a bit about the approach in terms of curating and capturing a century of audio design, because you've kind of spoken about some of the collaborations, you've spoken about some of your key moments in your own background and what inspired you, but how does one even begin to unravel an opportunity or a challenge like capturing 100 years of audio design?
It's quite broad, and I'm fortunate to have been at the museum for 17 years, and in that time, really thinking about our architecture and design collection with a mind towards future exhibitions. And so we've been acquiring important works over a number of years, thinking about audio equipment and this story around graphic design related to music, and really in earnest in the past 5 years, thinking specifically about this presentation. So being able to fill in certain gaps that give us a very broad range. And one of the inspiration points for the entire show is this collection of psychedelic rock posters. It's nearly 500 posters that were gifted to us in the mid-90s by a local collector named Jim Channon, an amazing collector of many different things, including radios and political posters. And Jim had gifted us this pristine set of Bill Graham posters, the Family Dog posters, but we'd only shown a handful here, a handful there. I'd never shown them all at once. And in fact, I'm not sure that this entire kind of numbered set has ever been shown in its entirety in one go. So that was a huge launching point of, okay, well, this is an opportunity to create something that actually is very immersive, where it's floor to ceiling. And thinking through that also led me to think through, well, what are some other important moments in graphic design history that we could call out alongside? And with the objects, I think it was pretty easy to say, well, 1924 or around 1924, 100 years ago, this is essentially the dawn of the radio era, where a regular consumer can acquire a radio. So that is a nice bookend to where we are today. So trying to think of what was happening in the mid-1920s, early 1920s, finding a couple key objects that could tell that story. But then we reached even further, and we included a wax cylinder gramophone designed by Thomas Edison, for example. Because I think lodged in our collective psyche is, you know, the Cygnet horn, for example, that accompanied those early playback devices, not just the wax cylinder gramophones, but the early phonographs to, you know, the acoustic speaker system before amplification. And then taking it from there, you know, as we step into amplification, as we step into the battery, electricity, all of these different elements that start to spell out our evolution. But like I mentioned, the concrete stereo was important to also include a couple objects that were a little bit more experimental or unique or small edition. So it's not just a survey of our material culture, but it is focused on this idea of playback.
Amazing, amazing. And you mentioned there that floor to ceiling collection, 500 posters, a donation to the museum. You are celebrating San Francisco's Bay Area music culture, you know, rightly so, you're really featuring it. Were there any other archives or collectors or performers who maybe helped to bring these stories to life?
Yes. We also borrowed a number of album covers from the Letterform Archive, which is right down the street from SF MoMA, an incredible resource for all things related to graphic design. And so in our exhibition, we have 128 album covers that is essentially just a little bit of a survey of the first 20 years of the 12-inch, which was commercialized around 1948. And in that new format of the 12 by 12 square becomes this canvas for creative output. One of the first designers who was really making work around this format was Alex Steinweiss, and he was doing a lot around classical music and kind of breaking the mold that had come prior with the 78s of you know, maybe a photograph of the musician and a serif typeface of who the musician was and what the music was, and really becoming much more creative compositionally and colorfully with that form. So we borrowed a number of album covers from Letterform Archive, but there are many different local lenders who have contributed to making this an important story.
I love it. Now, coming back to the exhibition, some of the audio products that are featured really seamlessly blend cutting-edge engineering with beautiful design aesthetics. Were there any pieces in particular that you feel nailed that beautiful integration of form and function?
There really are many in the exhibition that achieve that. And, you know, as a design curator, I'm always looking at both of these stories. What was its impact culturally, socially, and how has its aesthetic survived the test of time in a way? Beauty is very subjective, but I think that we can agree that when the form and the function come together, you can quickly tell that there is a synergy there, that these things are speaking to each other. So one of the objects that I really love is the Mario Bellini Pop Automatic Portable 45 player, which is this in this kind of vibrant cadmium red vermilion color, which I'm sure has some lead in the paint to make it so brilliant. The form of that matches the curvature of the 45, and also is in a way this kind of like a little carrier, like kind of like a purse for the 45, with this beautiful circular perforation pattern for the speaker. And these elements really go together in this very beautiful way. So I love that there are many objects that take into consideration the medium itself, if it's a cassette or a record or a mini disc, you know, many different things represented, but the relationship between what it's doing and what it looks like is really important.
Nice, nice. It seems throughout the exhibition like that creating an immersive multi-sensory experience was key. How did you balance static objects like all of those posters with the more dynamic audio installations?
Yeah, hugely important part of the exhibition. I really wanted to make sure that as you go through this space, you're reigniting your love of music and, of course, bringing forward the visual components of our shared musical experience is one part of that. But then to offer a more rarefied experience of actually listening to music was really important to round out that experience. So you go through the exhibition, you have this opportunity to sit in the teenage engineering design seating landscape and interact with their devices and listen to music. At the very end of the exhibition, in that direction, there is a gallery devoted to another work by teenage engineering called Choir, which is a set of 8 figurines that are singing, and they sing together in each of them in a different tonal range, so together forming a choir that sings a range of music from chamber music, Baroque music, barbershop, traditionals. So that gives you an opportunity to have a performance experience and also allows us to span a much greater range of time. If we're thinking about Baroque and music, 18th century music, but represented in kind of this synthesizer era. It's really a beautiful immersive experience. But really, I think the highlight of that more immersive aspect of the exhibition is on the very other end of the show. And that's a gallery that we've given over to the speaker builder, Devin Turnbull, who makes speakers and sound systems under the name Ojas. He's based in Brooklyn, and he's created for us an incredible hi-fi listening room. All custom-built speakers, power supplies, amplifiers, turntables, input selectors. This is really a bespoke presentation, not just of incredible audio devices and the equipment itself, but we've turned it into a platform for listening. And so every day during the run of the exhibition, we've handed the keys over to a different record collector or musician or archivist, and they are playing selections from their collections of music that really brings us into a contemplative, deep listening state. And that's a range of classical and jazz, new jazz, but also all sorts of different genres of music that allow us to give deference to sound itself.
Beautiful. I'm sure many people listening will be thinking about when they can come and worship at this temple of sound. How long is the exhibition scheduled to run for?
The show runs through August 18th.
August 18th, folks. We will, of course, be linking to the FS MoMA website in the show notes. My advice is get there ASAP. Now, for listeners who may not be able to experience the exhibition in person, what is one classic album you'd recommend that everyone should own or at least experience because of how powerfully the music and the artwork combine to create this iconic experience?
Well, you know how challenging that question is.
I know. I'm sorry. But I'm so curious.
Truly an impossible question. And you know, what's been so incredible about this exhibition is how much music I've been exposed to and how wide now, obviously music is so vast. And I came into the development of this exhibition really thinking that I had a handle on it. And I am so, so clearly in awe of so much of our collective musical output, and especially working with Devin Turnbull and his amazing taste in music. I've been exposed to so much music that really takes us into that kind of deep listening environment. But one album that I've always thought about as something that can activate that type of listening experience is an album by David Axelrod, Holy Thursday. And I think that that's just, you know, thinking about putting you in a state of giving over to music, that can take you there.
Couldn't agree with you more. That's absolutely a definitive release. I'm a huge fan of the Axe and the Electric Prunes and all of his productions. Who's that actor he worked with as well, who was sampled by Dre? Incredible stuff. I have one more question for you before I ask you an even more impossible question, which is to choose a favorite song. What is one item that you would have loved to add to the exhibition, but it didn't quite work out this time around? What's missing?
So many things are missing, potentially, because, again, this really only skims the surface. But we've done our best to include as many things as we could. And really, the exhibition expanded into the seventh floor. It had previously been in a smaller space. And so we kind of rapidly thought about adding these icons and pieces here and there. The one thing that I had kind of wanted to include, but proved very difficult and ultimately made sense to not include, is a representation from this subculture of mostly Dominican van builders, who transform these minivans and other cars into these kind of mobile, insane walls of sound, where the trunk opens up and out unfolds 36 15-inch subwoofers. And these vans kind of compete both for their aesthetics and for the power of their amplification. And as objects themselves, they really speak volumes. I think that you would literally be blown away by their max output. And of course, that was a consideration if we were to put something like that in the show, and we'd be tempted to turn it on, and it very likely could knock some paintings off the wall. That was something that I had tried to chase down, but didn't make sense to include in the show.
Mm. Oh, I hear you. Yeah, that would have been impressive slash dangerously Moorish, I would say. So we have reached the final question of the show. It's one that we ask all of our VIP guests, from A.R. Rahman to Suzanne Chani, and that is to choose a track for our VIP title playlist. And just tell us a little bit about why you chose it.
And I assume I can't choose the David Axelrod Holy Thursday track.
Oh, you sure can. Oh my goodness, please do. Yes.
I mean, now I'm like stuck thinking about the opening sequence of that song. I mean, again, this is something that I think puts you in that state of mind. But there are so many tracks. In fact, I think maybe because we talked about David Axelrod, and we can encourage folks to listen to his music. There is a song that I played the other day in Devin Turnbull's Hi-Fi, which is by this musician. You know, I don't have all of the details of their career, but the musician's name is Chiwaniso. And the song is called, you know, I actually can't pronounce this very well. Zivichapera, I think, is how you pronounce it. This is an amazing song that was recorded right before this musician died at a young age of 36. And I think it's just a very powerful, beautiful, poetic, meditative track. I wish I could pronounce the name of the song correctly, because I realize this is a podcast and we're very audio focused.
Do not worry about that at all. We will be linking to that from the show notes. Dear listeners, do head over to the title playlist. It's going to have this incredible track on it, joining all of the others from all of the 70 plus episodes of the Audio Talks podcast. And I am going to add a track myself to the playlist, inspired by a photograph that our dear friend and colleague Carol Campbell sent over from the FS MoMA, from the Art of Noise. It was this huge wall of posters, and then there was a poster of the Beatles arriving in America, and there were three support bands, and they were The Circle with a Y, The Ronettes, and The Remains. And that reminded me of one of the best records ever made, hands down, which is Don't Look Back by The Remains. So that's going into the podcast from myself, roundabout from our dear friend Carol, who visited the Art of Noise at FS MoMA. So thank you so much for joining us, SF MoMA Associate Curator of Architecture and Design, Joseph Becker.
Thank you so much, Roisin.
Listeners, don't forget to subscribe, comment, and share Audio Talks with your friends and family. If you're enjoying the Audio Talks series of podcasts, why not pop over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts and leave a nice review. It really does mean a lot, and it helps new listeners to get to know about the artful guests we talk to in every episode, like Joseph Becker. For more exclusive content, some behind-the-scenes goodies, and maybe even some competitions, connect with us over on the Instagram. You can find us at Audio Talks Podcast. We'll be back soon for more exquisitely curated Audio Talks. See you next time.